Welcome to Nightlights. I'm David Brent Johnson. In January 1943, bandleader and composer Duke Ellington took his orchestra into Carnegie Hall for the first time and chose to make his debut with an ambitious 45-minute long musical depiction of the African-American experience called Black, Brown, and Beige. In the next hour, we'll hear music from that concert performance, as well as Ellington's subsequent revisitations of his work. We'll speak with jazz artist Wynton Marsalis and Ellington historian Harvey Cohen, and we'll hear Duke Ellington himself reflecting on his extended composition. It's Black, Brown, and Beige, Duke Ellington's historic jazz symphony, coming up on this edition of Nightlights.
And to open our show today, excerpts from Black, Brown, and Beige, a tone parallel to the history of the American Negro, written by Duke Ellington himself. The opening portion is the work song theme. Duke?
Thank you.
Duke Ellington's work song, the beginning of his extended work Black, Brown, and Beige, heard on a U.S. Department of Treasury-sponsored radio broadcast in 1945. January 23, 1943. The United States and its allies were at war with the Axis powers in Europe and Africa and across the Pacific, immersed in a conflict that encircled the globe. The renowned 43-year-old African-American bandleader Duke Ellington was making his debut that evening at New York City's Carnegie Hall, one of the most esteemed concert halls in the world. As Ellington often did in these years, he began with a performance of the Star-Spangled Banner. The concert was also a fundraiser for Russian war relief, as the Soviet Union remained under brutal siege from invading German armies. Among the full house at Carnegie were celebrities and artists such as First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, conductor Leopold Stokowski, soprano Marian Anderson, and poet Langston Hughes. For Ellington, it was a dramatic opportunity to present a work that had been a long time forming, a panoramic musical history of the African-American experience that he called Black, Brown, and Beige. It was a 45-minute long jazz symphony constructed in what Ellington called the Negro idiom, and it proved to be an artistic success ahead of its time. Performed at a moment when many scholars believe the Ellington Band and its composer to have been at a creative zenith, with the nation in the midst of war and black people still living under segregation, Black, Brown, and Beige is a complex American masterpiece that sets out to broaden a people's and a country's sense of its history. Very few jazz artists had ever appeared at Carnegie Hall. African-American bandleader James Reese Europe had performed there in 1912, and Benny Goodman and other swing musicians had played it in 1938 and 39. Duke Ellington's debut there was widely covered in the media and seen as a moment of artistic arrival for the composer, who at this point had already been leading a band for nearly 20 years and had scored numerous hits, such as It Don't Mean a Thing If It Ain't Got That Swing and Don't Get Around Much Anymore. Harvey Cohen is the author of Duke Ellington's America, which devotes an entire chapter to Black, Brown, and Beige, and puts Ellington's music and career in the cultural context of his times.
When you played at Carnegie Hall, you were seen as one of the premier classical artists in the world in the 40s. And back then, it was mostly classical artists that were playing this venue, although some jazz performers had played there before Ellington, Benny Goodman, I think. But it was still really different that Ellington was there and that he was going to do this new piece that was the longest piece he'd ever written up to that point, and might still be one of the longest pieces he's ever written. And it just meant that he was there with America's finest, that this marketing of Ellington as a great composer was proving even more true than it had in the 1930s when Ellington and his manager started that marketing campaign. And he, along with people like Benny Goodman, were showing that jazz, this uniquely American, uniquely African-American music, belonged there just as much as any other kind of music. It's a really big deal. And in the black newspapers, it was trumpeted. It was seen as like a lot of Ellington's career and achievements, it was seen as this occasion of great race pride, you know, as they would say in those days. So yeah, it was a huge thing. And like I said, when you go through the scrapbooks of clippings at the Smithsonian, this is probably the biggest overall burst of publicity in his career. And I would say rightly so.
There were precedents for Black, Brown, and Beige in the music and the education and the historical pageants that Ellington was exposed to growing up in Washington, D.C. The compositions and concerts of artists such as James Reese Europe, James P. Johnson, and in Ellington's own work over the past 15 years, pieces such as Creole Rhapsody, Symphony in Black, and his 1941 social significance musical review, Jump for Joy. And Ellington had talked from time to time in interviews of an ambitious opus that would tell the story of the African-American experience, from its origins in Africa to its current state in America. It is thought by some scholars that Black, Brown, and Beige grew in part out of Bula, an operatic work which Ellington had cited as being in progress throughout the 1930s. However long Black, Brown, and Beige had been forming in Ellington's mind, however, he ended up writing much of it in a six-week sprint, as he recalled to music critic Carter Harmon years later.
So William Morris says to me, well, what do you need is a Carnegie Hall concert? So I started whipping up the material for the Carnegie Hall concert. And we planned it for... It was a big Russian war relief, and we played it. And on January 23rd, 1943, and I think I started writing Black, Brown, and Beige on the 19th of December. We were playing the theater in Hartford, and Frank Sinatra was the extra added attraction. He was there that weekend. We started, and I wrote it. Was writing it all the way down from Hartford down to Bridgeport, you know, out to Detroit and various other places. I was always writing in the hotel, in backstage of the theater, Columbus, Ohio. And then we got back to New York and introduced Black, Brown, and Beige. Tremendous success, you know.
What Ellington produced, a 45-minute long jazz symphony, as well as a long manuscript that provided a wealth of narrative detail for the story he wished to tell, a manuscript that has remained unpublished, was extraordinary for its time.
Like Jim Europe, Ellington was making the argument, without saying it, that African-American music at Carnegie Hall was going to be different than what was usually seen there. And he had a good knowledge of African-American history. And what he was basically trying to put together with Black, Brown, and Beige was this mix of struggle and achievement and patriotism. And of course, I mentioned patriotism because this is, Black, Brown, and Beige is premiered at Carnegie in the middle of World War II in January 1943. I think basically Ellington, he wanted to write a programmatic musical history. Programmatic means that the music is trying to send out certain images or tell certain stories through the melodies and through the moods and so forth. But he was trying to create this black history written by blacks that was not tainted by the usual stereotypes that usually accompanied African Americans in the American mass media and in the historical profession too. He wanted a history that wasn't tainted by racism, something that he was always trying to do throughout his career. I would also say too, he covers a really wide swath of history according to the written scenario that he wrote to illustrate Black, Brown, and Beige. And he goes back to ancient history and African history and, these kind of historical feats that blacks don't get enough credit for, like the smelting of iron, for instance, he talks about. And I think also what's really important, to quote a really important American historian named Constance Rourke, who wrote a book named American Humor in 1930, I think Ellington is trying to give African Americans what Constance Rourke said was a usable past to work from, to live up to show that black history was something proud and important, and that you could base works of music or literature or art on it, Once again, Ellington trying to evade and really destroy those racial stereotypes.
Duke Ellington introducing Black, Brown, and Beige in January 1943.
Thank you. And now comes our latest attempt, our most serious attempt, and definitely our longest composition. However, in mentioning the length of Black, Brown, and Beige, we would like to say that this is a parallel to the history of the American Negro, and of course, it tells a long story. And I hope that you will take into consideration the fact that in telling the story of the work song, for instance, which is the first theme, we use it in its many forms. For instance, when, the work song is sung while you work, of course, there's a place for the song, and then there's a place to grunt, and the impact of your work. And, of course, after that comes the spiritual theme, which is the second theme of the first movement. And today we find that the two are very closely related. And so it naturally necessitates developing the two and showing their close relationship. The first movement of Black, Brown, and Beige is called Black.
Thank you.
music from Black, the opening movement of Duke Ellington's historic jazz symphony. Wynton Marsalis, the artistic director of jazz at Lincoln Center, has performed at Black, Brown, and Beige in its entirety with the center's orchestra.
For me as a musician, what makes it significant is the craftsmanship of it. Just studying it, it's unbelievably well crafted. I mean, he was what he was. When you get these kind of genius figures who figure out a lot of things, have original techniques, have a dedicated 50 years, he just stayed on the road writing music. They have insights, and those insights are in their art, and it's in his music. And the sentiment of the piece and the craftsmanship. And, I mean, when we play it and we're rehearsing it, we always are singing tunes from it and saying, man, Duke.
As always, Ellington captured a wide spectrum of humanity and emotion in his work, including humor, pathos, pride, and spirituality. In a late-night interview, he reminisced about Black, Brown, and Beige to music critic Carter Harmon.
Black, Brown, and Beige, the reason the number was titled Black, Brown, and Beige, because I started off with the entrance of the Negro into America in 1619 off of the slave ships. But apparently when he was there, I mean, it was on the slave ships, it was better you should read it, maybe.
Yeah, you got a script?
I have a thing I wrote a long time ago.
Yeah?
Some of it might be changed now. Well, I'll explain the black, brown, and beige.
Yeah.
It has to do with the state of mind, not the color of the skin.
Uh-huh.
Because when they arrived, everything looked real black, you know.
I see.
A Negro thought that when he was being brought here from Africa, that he was being brought as food because he was a very delicious thing. And they expected to be eaten.
God.
And when they got here, they found out that all they had to do was work.
Yeah.
And,
I've never heard that before.
It lightened.
It lightened, yeah.
And got to be brown. And with the entrance of the spiritual, which was later. The first thing they did was work, and that was the work song.
Yeah.
And the next thing was the spiritual, which came from singing counter melodies to the hymns being sung in the church. They were on the outside of the church.
Huh. Is that historical fact too?
That's right.
I didn't know that either.
And so gradually it got lighter. And of course, in black, brown, and beige, of course, we went on up to cream and so forth, various other degrees of it. We never got quite white, though, you know.
Yeah.
There's still a little jazz in there.
Harvey Cohen on what made Black, Brown, and Beige an unusual work.
Black, Brown, and Beige, if you listen to it, did not have the standard big band sound, even though it was being performed and it was written for a big jazz band. Some of the music resembles jazz, some of it's danceable, but the tempo changes all of the time. And a lot of people did believe at that time that, you know, big band music, it always has to be danceable. But, you know, Ellington was painting on a different canvas, and he had different things he wanted to say. And as we all know, the story of African American history is not always a happy one, you know. So he wanted to work with different colors in his musical palette. He wanted to work with different genres. And I think this alienated people at first, because nobody else was really doing it. Maybe some people in the classical world were, but to combine all these different styles and genres in one 45-minute piece, it was quite a daring move.
Music from the opening movement of Duke Ellington's Black, Brown, and Beige, which made its debut at Carnegie Hall on January 23, 1943, the section which came to be known as Come Sunday, featuring saxophonist Johnny Hodges. Heard in its entirety at Carnegie Hall, Black, Brown, and Beige was very much a newly born work with the Ellington Orchestra. Certain elements would gain more polish in later reprises. But concertgoers got to hear the full array of devices that Ellington employed to convey his narrative of African Americans arriving in America as slaves, fighting as soldiers on behalf of the country that enslaved them, and searching for a better life in the decades following emancipation.
He would put in little historical quotes, like when the music in the Brown movement is talking about blacks fighting the Revolutionary War, he puts in a little melodic snippet of the old Revolutionary War standard, "The Girl I Left Behind Me." A little bit later on, he puts in a little musical snippet of "Yankee Doodle." But it's kind of slowed down and maybe mirrors some of the more negative parts of African-American history in America.
He just understood how to put everything together. He understood what binds us. And he was he had a spiritual insight, and he had an optimism that was not naive, and he had a depth of intellectual engagement with music and a virtuosity and an embrace of what a myriad of people could do. So his music is always friendly to all the sections, great trombone, great trumpets, great saxophones, rhythm section. He gives everybody something to play that is significant and meaningful.
And now, the next and second movement, which is Brown, is divided into three divisions. Of course, the first is the salute to the West Indian influence, and the second, the lighter attitude. Of course, that is representative of the younger generation who had so much to look forward to when the proclamation of emancipation was declared and came as a skyrocket. But of course, there's two sides to all stories, and there was just a small group of very old people who had earned the right to sit down and rest on somebody's property, and of course, their song was a very plaintive but tragic one. It's represented, and I wanted to call particular attention to it because it's represented in a couple of duets, one of the baritone and tenor sax, and the other with the trumpet and trombone duets. The third, of course, which we call Mauve, and is the blues that follows after the many triangles that developed after the great Negro heroes of the Spanish-American War. And as I say, the blues is born of these triangles. The second movement.
Thank you.
Brown, the second movement of Duke Ellington's Black, Brown, and Beige, performed at Carnegie Hall on January 23, 1943, featuring Betty Roche on vocals. I'll have more of Duke Ellington's Black, Brown, and Beige, including the critical response to the Carnegie concert, in just a few moments. You can listen to previous Nightlights programs, including shows about Duke Ellington's Jump for Joy and other Ellington works, on our website at indianapublicmedia.org/nightlights. Support comes from Landlocked Music, offering new and used CDs, LPs, and more. Now located in the David Baker Building at 115 South Walnut in downtown Bloomington. And from the Laughing Planet Cafe, serving veggie burgers, salads, and burritos for lunch and dinner at the corner of Kirkwood and Grant in Bloomington. The Laughing Planet Cafe, online at thelaughingplanetcafe.com. I'm David Brent Johnson, and you're listening to Black, Brown, and Beige, Duke Ellington's historic jazz symphony on Nightlights. Featuring Duke Ellington's historic jazz symphony Black, Brown, and Beige on this edition of Nightlights. The January 1943 Carnegie Hall concert, at which Black, Brown, and Beige debuted, was in many ways a great success for Ellington. He was booked in the New York City's popular Hurricane Club for 6 months afterwards, and throughout the rest of the 1940s, he appeared at Carnegie Hall every year, almost always debuting ambitious new works such as New World A-Comin' and The Liberian Suite, though none came close to the length of Black, Brown, and Beige. Black, Brown, and Beige put Ellington into the realm of the concert hall, but not everybody thought that he belonged there. The reviews for Black, Brown, and Beige were decidedly mixed, and Ellington found himself under attack from both classical critics such as Paul Bowles and jazz figures such as John Hammond, both of whom criticized Ellington for attempting to work in longer forms. Ellington historian Harvey Cohen.
Most critics were not prepared to deal with Black, Brown, and Beige. They think Duke Ellington, they think jazz band, they think danceable, and he was famous for his ballads too, but he was, you know, he was mostly doing songs that were like 3 or 4 minutes long, and that's what other jazz bands were doing too, and he was known as a great composer, but still most people were not expecting and just could not deal with a 3-movement 45 minute musical panorama about the history of African Americans. It's very long, you know, and the critics just weren't used to such music. A lot of the critics at the time argued that Ellington was unqualified to write such music, that he needed some sort of classical conservatory training to do that. But Ellington totally rejected this, and this whole idea was just balderdash, because Ellington was going to write about black history from the black perspective. And he was not going to use the usual kind of European musical vocabulary that American classical concerts usually followed. You know, he wanted to write, there's some quote I use in the chapter about how he wanted to write this story from the inside as a black man.
In December 1943, the Ellington Orchestra returned to Carnegie Hall and played a brief set of selections from Black, Brown, and Beige. Ellington offered a more subdued introduction this time around.
Next we play a very short sketch from Brown, which is the second section of Black, Brown, and Beige. We thought we wouldn't play it in its entirety tonight because it represents an awfully long and a very important story. And in that, I don't think too many people are familiar with the story. We thought it would be better to wait until the story was a little more familiar before we did the whole thing again.
But Ellington would not perform the whole thing again.
In 1943, we started doing a series of Carnegie Hall concerts every year. Started with Black, Brown, and Beige. In its original performance, it was 47 minutes long. We have performed it very little, and we have never performed it totally since then, since that year.
Wynton Marsalis.
You know, he revisited it one time, but he went away from it as a larger piece because everybody was so critical of him. It affected him. He redid it and he shortened it, but he never really went back to it in its entirety, and he didn't play it in its entirety. I wish he had played it. Sometimes you can be discouraged by things and this and that, but I wish he did just keep reiterating things over and over. And of course, he was always writing new music, so I don't know what he was thinking.
Black, Brown, and Beige is known to have been performed in its entirety by the Ellington Orchestra only four times, all within the first few weeks of 1943. Ellington historian Harvey Cohen says the work faced several obstacles in gaining wider acceptance.
I think Ellington thought that, you know, Black, Brown, and Beige was some sort of a failure in some ways. But I don't think it was a failure. It's obviously a great composition. But there was no way to promote a 45-minute piece like that, especially in the pop music and the jazz music market. You know, you couldn't hear it on the radio. You couldn't buy it in a store. It was too long to put it on a recording at that time. And a lot of the critics on the first night don't like it because they don't get a chance to hear it repeatedly and appreciate it. So it was kind of a tough thing. You know, it had to do with technology and, you know, how you could hear music. And in some ways, Ellington and Strayhorn were like, they were ahead of the curve, you know. They were making these 45-minute compositions, and there was nowhere to kind of promote those compositions at the time.
Ellington did frequently perform excerpts from Black, Brown, and Beige in the next several years, including the Carnegie Hall concerts that became an annual event for him until the end of the 1940s. Black, Brown, and Beige was also hampered by the Musician Union's recording ban that was in effect throughout 1943 and much of 1944. But finally, in December of that year, Ellington was able to record a four-part, 18-minute-long version for the Victor label that was packaged in a lavishly illustrated and notated folio of 278 records. From that release, here's the Duke Ellington Orchestra performing Work Song on Nightlights.
Thank you.
Duke Ellington's December 1944 Victor's studio recording of Work Song, the opening of Black, Brown, and Beige. Though Victor's deluxe packaging of the double 78 Black, Brown, and Beige at last made some of the Work's music commercially available, and though pieces continue to appear in Ellington's concert repertoire, Ellington's artistic and professional pace carried him away from his landmark work. Still, its importance and Ellington's own sense that it had not achieved all that he had hoped it would eventually revived his creative aspirations for it. In 1956, Ellington told music critic Carter Harmon that he was working on an expanded presentation of his jazz symphony.
You know Black, Brown, and Beige? Well, I have almost completed that as a stage presentation, you know, with songs and narration and all that. And tell all of the things about the Negro in America, you know.
So, yes.
Negro's contributions and so forth.
That presentation never came to pass. But in 1958, Ellington did make a studio LP called Black, Brown, and Beige that refashioned some of the material from the 1943 Carnegie Hall version, and which included a stunning rendition of Come Sunday by gospel singer Mahalia Jackson.
Lord, God Almighty, God above, please look down and see my people through.
Mahalia Jackson and Duke Ellington performing Come Sunday from the 1958 sessions for the Columbia album Black, Brown, and Beige. There is further ample evidence that Ellington never forgot or let go of Black, Brown, and Beige. He incorporated some of it into his 1963 opus My People, written for the Century of Negro Progress Exposition in Chicago, and elements appeared in his sacred concerts of the 1960s as well. And in 1965, Ellington made a private recording of the entire work, eventually released more than 20 years later. From that recording, here's part of the Beige movement, known as Sugar Hill Penthouse, representing the ascendance of black people to a better life in Harlem on Nightlights.
Thank you.
Sugar Hill Penthouse, featuring saxophonists Harry Carney and Paul Gonzalez, originally part of the Beige movement from Duke Ellington's Black, Brown, and Beige, recorded in 1965. When Duke Ellington passed away in 1974 at the age of 75, very few people had ever heard Black, Brown, and Beige in its entirety. 3 years later, the January 1943 concert was finally released as a triple LP. In recent decades, book-length scholarly studies have been devoted to Black, Brown, and Beige, and it has been performed by other orchestras, including jazz at Lincoln Center. Black, Brown, and Beige is a musical mural of African-American history that has ultimately realized its creator's hopes, even if he did not live to see those hopes fulfilled.
The legacy and significance of Black, Brown, and Beige today is this whole idea that African Americans can do any kind of music they want. It doesn't just have to be the torrid, danceable, sexy music. And I think it's also telling us that the history of African Americans is something really important. It's really a central story in American history, and it needs to be recognized in American culture and American music. And this goes up very much against, you know, usually when you saw an African American in the mass media in 1943, usually that person was working in a menial job or was being portrayed as some sort of ugly, racist, minstrel sort of stereotype. And here was Ellington, like almost nobody else in the culture at that time. You know, he was always dressed on stage and in the movies and in advertisements as somebody who was formally dressed, who was a genius, who was a serious composer. And of course, that wasn't just hype, you know. That was the truth.
Well, what makes works of art relevant is the intrinsic value of the art. What is it saying about us as a people? What does it say about human beings? How does it connect with us? But there's so much in that piece of music, the form, the structure, the harmony, the sophistication of it, the message, the uplift in it. It was written during the wartime, and it tells a tale that's important to know about American history. And it's Duke Ellington, and the depth of his genius and his insight into the nature of the American proposition is such that when he did things, they were significant. And this was the thing that was very important to him. And it will remain relevant as long as we practice our form of democracy, because his music is relevant to us.
For the music that I wanted to hear, it was a matter of hearing people working, bending over a wash tub humming, or just walking through the street in the dark whistling, or maybe it's somebody playing a piano or guitar or something. Or you might hear the cat blowing the blues on a whistle on a train, you know. This is all people's music. This is the kind of music when you ask them, say, what was that? And they say, oh, nothing.
Duke Ellington made it into something. I close with Duke Ellington's 1944 studio recording of three dances from his Black, Brown, and Beige Jazz Symphony. Thanks for tuning in this edition of Nightlights. Special thanks to Harvey Cohen, Todd Gould, Wynton Marcellus, Michael Pascash, Kay Peterson, Casey Zakin, and the Smithsonian Archives Center. You can hear previous Nightlights programs on our website at indianapublicmedia.org/nightlights. Support comes from Landlocked Music, offering new and used CDs, LPs, and more. Now located in the David Baker Building at 115 South Walnut in downtown Bloomington, or online at landlockedmusic.com. And from the Laughing Planet Cafe, serving veggie burgers, salads, and burritos for lunch and dinner at the corner of Kirkwood and Grant in Bloomington. The Laughing Planet Cafe, online at thelaughingplanetcafe.com. I'm David Brent Johnson, wishing you good listening for the week ahead.